Hello there, and thanks for being with us today on this Wednesday, February 27th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump has arrived in Vietnam for a high-stakes summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The president's former self-described fixer is in Washington telling Congress what he knows.
I expect that when Cohen is under oath, now that he's in a truth-telling mood, I think we're going to find out about illegal behavior that we didn't expect and didn't know about during the time when Cohen was working for Trump.
Also ahead, Americans may not realize their toilet paper comes from ancient forests. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump arrived in Vietnam Tuesday night for his second summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, hopeful of mapping a certain path toward Pyongyang's denuclearization. He stepped off Air Force One, greeted by key Vietnamese officials and U.S. Ambassador Daniel Crittenbrink, along with a white-uniformed honor guard flanking both sides of a long red carpet. The two leaders are set to meet briefly Wednesday before having a social dinner, along with two key aides and an interpreter from each side, with Trump accompanied by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. Trump and Kim will hold more formal talks on Thursday. And joining us now live from Hanoi, Vietnam, where the summit is being held, VOA correspondent Bill Gallo. Hi, Bill. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, we've heard about different scenarios that might be possible for a tentative deal, including some limited sanctions, possibly, or sanction relief, I should say, or maybe a Korean War declaration. The president seems very willing to trust Kim. Are any of these feasible, and will there be a condition of verifying before they start?
That really is the key. Will this be verifiable if they agree to any steps here? As you mentioned, there are reports about a tentative deal. Those are unconfirmed reports, but it involves, as you mentioned, the U.S. relaxing some limited sanctions in exchange for some sort of nuclear step by North Korea that could involve, for instance, the Yongbyon nuclear facility, which is one of North Korea's main nuclear facilities. But just what they would dismantle or disable or what they would give up isn't clear. It's not clear how far the U.S. is willing to go to relax sanctions. But the other parts of that possible deal include, as you mentioned, a Korean War, an end to the Korean War, some kind of formal announcement of ending that war, and then also establishing liaison offices, possibly in each other's countries. So those are steps that could be taken these next 2 days.
Well, the president called the first summit a big success, and he said that North Korea was no longer a threat right after that. But that has been disputed since then by U.S. intelligence officials. The president can't really come back with no concrete plan or agreement. So what needs to happen for the president to avoid political backlash?
They need to move this process forward somehow. These two leaders agreed in Singapore to work towards the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. U.S. officials now openly concede that they don't even know what that idea means as far as, you know, how North Korea views denuclearization. The two sides have long had differing opinions of what denuclearization is, so they have to reach an agreement there. They have to come to some sort of framework, some sort of understanding, whether or not that has timelines for denuclearization. That's not clear. Another thing they might have to do is, as we mentioned, some step that moves this process forward, and I don't know what that is. There will be debate whether it will be enough, but, you know, I guess we'll see in the next day or two, you know, what comes out of it.
All right. Well, the last summit, the president did not press Kim on the grave human rights violations and concerns the world has in about North Korea. Is he expected to bring it up at this one?
I think there is a widespread expectation that that will not be brought up at the summit. I mean, the evidence of that, I think, is Donald Trump's very recent tweet in which he called Kim Jong-un his friend. Of course, Donald Trump has said that he's fallen in love with Kim Jong-un. I think this is an attempt to sort of gain trust with the North Korean leader, perhaps, you know, make him feel more comfortable about giving up his nuclear weapons eventually. But there is a lot of concern of treating a man who's really considered one of the worst rights abusers in this way. I mean, it's really surreal here in Hanoi to see Kim Jong-un's motorcade pass on the streets and people wave flags and scream and cheer. as if he's a celebrity. It's very, very notable. There are even, you know, stores here selling Kim Jong-un T-shirts and drinks and things like this. This is a man who is no longer as isolated as he was, and he's actually being cheered in many parts of the world now. So that is notable, I will say for sure.
Absolutely. Wow, that's quite the picture you just painted there for us. Well, we will certainly be talking to you again more about this as the week progresses, but we thank you so much for joining us. That is VOA correspondent Bill Gallo coming to us live from Hanoi, Vietnam. Thanks so much, Bill.
Thank you.
And continuing this story, President Trump's National Security Advisor John Bolton has said that the whole reason for the second summit is needed because many say it wasn't needed or for a second summit is needed is the reason many say it wasn't needed or deserved by Kim. VOA Asia's Ira Melman talked about this with former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., former governor of New Mexico, Bill Richardson, who has also been called upon numerous times to troubleshoot diplomatic issues on North Korea.
Well, I agree with John Bolton. North Korea has not lived up to its commitments since the first summit. They said they would start to denuclearize their missiles, their nuclear weapons, their weapons of mass destruction, and they've done hardly anything. They have proceeded with return of some of our remains of our soldiers. They have stopped testing their nuclear weapons, but that's a commitment they'd already made. But when it comes to destroying some of their arsenal, they've done very little. They've blown up a couple of sites for PR reasons, and it's very important that the president come back with an agreement that at least partially destroys some of their nuclear arsenal, and that's doubtful right now.
Will that ever be the case, and what is acceptable as far as the United States is concerned, as far as you are concerned?
Well, I want the president to succeed. I think it's good that there's less tension in the region, but I want to be sure that the North Koreans live up to their commitments, which they didn't do in the Clinton and the Bush and the Obama administration. Nonetheless, it's good that the two leaders at the highest level are talking. But North Korea needs to take significant steps or a framework of negotiation, perhaps over several years, that in exchange for sanctions relief, they really will curb or destroy many of their nuclear arsenal so it doesn't threaten Japan, so it doesn't threaten South Korea. And until then, the sanctions have to be kept on. Kim Jong-un, I think, has been underestimated. He has a vision. I just hope the president listens to his advisors, listens to his nuclear negotiator on North Korea, listens to John Bolton to make sure the North Koreans live up to their commitment to destroy their nuclear arsenal, which they did at the first summit in Singapore.
The very definition of the term denuclearization is still up in the air, as it's been up in the air since you were there last time and well before that, I would imagine. And that is the United States and the rest of the world seem to think that it calls for the denuclearization of North Korea. While many, we are heard, and you've spent a lot of time in North Korea, are saying that they are calling for the denuclearization of the entire Korean Peninsula.
Well, that's right. I think the North Koreans have a different definition, and we have a different definition. With us, it's basically destroying the arsenal. With the North Koreans, their idea is, you know, doing little explosions at some of the missile sites, at the same time take certain steps like freeze their existing arsenal, which is not the same as eliminating their nuclear capacity. So this is where we are, big definitional cultural differences. But I think as long as we keep talking, even if this summit is not successful and we keep negotiating, that's good for the region, for the peninsula, for Japan, for the United States, for South Korea, for millions of people that have been threatened by North Korea's nuclear arsenal that live right next to the DMZ in the region.
All right, that's former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. and former Governor of New Mexico, Bill Richardson. While President Trump is in Hanoi for his second summit with Kim Jong-un to try to persuade the North Korean leader to dismantle his country's nuclear weapons program, Michael Cohen, Trump's former longtime personal lawyer, will be appearing before a House oversight panel to provide an intimate look at the Trump business empire in what promises to be a riveting televised hearing Wednesday. While some Republicans are expected to say Cohen is a convicted felon now and a proven liar, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin says he hopes Michael Cohen will tell the truth to Congress this time.
He has no reason to lie again. It's not going to be helpful to him to lie again, and he's admitted he's lied. I think he was just in it. I would be very hopeful that he would be forthcoming and very, very honest, and I think you can tell that.
Cohen will be the highest-profile witness since the 1970s Watergate scandal to testify in Congress against a sitting American president. Cohen's tell-all public testimony providing potentially damaging evidence about Trump's political and business activities both before and after his 2016 presidential victory will come. I talked about it earlier with author and associate professor of policy and government at George Mason University, Jeremy Mayer. Thank you for being with us, Jeremy. Do you think that we will actually hear anything new? Will he bring anything new to light, even though many investigations are still ongoing?
I think there's a high possibility that he'll bring new information because he's the first real anti-Trump voice with insider knowledge. People who are on Trump's team have testified on Capitol Hill in open session. In fact, Cohen was one of them. But nobody who's flipped has come forward and testified in this sort of environment, particularly someone who has known Trump for as long as Michael Cohen did and who had known Trump as well as Michael Cohen.
What kinds of things do you think he could offer? I believe he's been told he's not allowed to talk about the Russia investigation, but anything else is open.
So Cohen is supposed to not talk about Russia in open session, and that's a deal that he worked out with the committee. Now, we don't know what the reason for that silence is.
What could it be?
It could be that they don't want to damage an ongoing investigation. Mm-hmm. So it could be that neither side wants to hurt criminal investigation. It could be that the seriousness of Cohen's criminal cases involving Russia is not fully determined, and thus he might expose himself somehow. I don't really know, and I don't think anyone does. But what I find most interesting is that the possibility that Cohen is going to open up not just about payments to former mistresses and lovers of Trump, but about the ongoing behavior of Trump organization. So Cohen was there for so many years before Trump got into politics that he might be able to talk about some of the shadier aspects of the Trump organization. The things that I think could hurt Trump would be if there have been other payments to more women before the election and during the election that he might talk about, as well as other shady aspects of Trump's behavior prior to politics, because Cohen really was his bag man. He'll know an awful lot.
Do you think that Cohen is doing this now to try to potentially rework his sentence so he doesn't do as much time in prison, or do you think this is just his way of showing remorse?
You don't get a reduction in your sentence from a judge for testifying to Congress. That's not how this works. So I doubt he's trying to help himself directly. But I do think if we are to believe the man, and believing Michael Cohen is a little tough given his record with the truth, he is on a path of redemption. He feels bad about the things he's taken part in. And I find that believable. I would certainly feel bad if I had done the things that Cohen has done. I do think that Republicans are facing a challenge with how to question him. And I think we saw that today with a Republican congressman from Florida who basically said, "Hey, Cohen, before you testify, are you sure you want to say bad things about the president? Because we can tell everyone about your mistresses and girlfriends, mm-hmm. and that'll hurt your marriage," which is textbook example of witness intimidation.
That was on Twitter, too.
It is remarkable that someone would put that out in public saying, mm-hmm. "If you testify, I'm going to ruin you." It's like a mafia statement.
And of course, Republicans will probably go after Cohen saying you're a convicted perjurer. We already heard that from White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, that this man isn't believable anyway. So what does Cohen need to do in order to be credible?
I don't think there's anything Michael Cohen could say that will convince Trump supporters that Trump isn't the guy they think he is. I don't expect him to move the needle on the Trump base. But I do think he has a chance to talk to, say, that 15 to 20% of Americans that are gettable. And if he appears to be that man on a path of redemption that he talks about being, I think it could matter on the margin. I think Cohen is going to say something that we don't know, that is not common knowledge. The thing about the Trump Organization is it's just so dirty, and it always has been dirty. As the New York Times showed a few months ago, it was dirty from birth, that it was breaking the law on a massive scale. I expect that when Cohen is under oath, now that he's in a truth-telling mood, I think we're going to find out about illegal behavior that we didn't expect and didn't know about during the time when Cohen was working for Trump, the years that he was right at his elbow as he was probably breaking the law on a massive scale.
All right, that is author and associate professor of policy and government at George Mason University, Jeremy Mayer. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Nigeria's Buhari wins second term as president. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro accuses the U.S. of fabricating a crisis. A U.S. judge delays the admitted Russian agent Butina's sentencing. And a bipartisan task force report says U.S. efforts to battle extremism are unsustainable. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The president's emergency declaration that would move funds from the military to pay for his border wall is facing an onslaught of legal challenges from private citizens and advocacy organizations, as well as more than a dozen states. On Tuesday, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a resolution to block the president's declaration for border wall funding. The resolution will now go to the Senate for a vote, but as Associated Press White House correspondent Sagar Magani tells us, it's not likely to get past a presidential veto.
Senate Democratic Chief Chuck Schumer says the president's undercut his own argument.
I didn't need to do this.
An emergency, by definition, is something you need to do. It's an emergency.
Which Democrats say it's not. Many Republicans say they back the president's authority to declare the emergency, but Lisa Murkowski is among a few GOP senators saying they'll vote for the resolution.
He is overstepping into the legislative prerogative.
Even if both chambers block the declaration, the president's sure to win in the end. GOP leaders are confident there would not be enough votes to override an almost certain presidential veto. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Well, coalition-backed Syrian forces are close to defeating the last Islamic State militant stronghold in Syria, but the battle is fierce as militants defend their web of tunnels inside a camp crowded with women and children. In recent days, thousands more people have poured out of the battle zone, some near death and others vowing that IS will fight on. VOA Middle East correspondent Heather Murdoch is on scene in Syria and has this report.
It appears to be the last days of the Islamic State group's self-proclaimed caliphate. It is now a fight for a cluster of tents with perhaps 1,000 or more people inside. Authorities say they have been stunned by the number of people that have fled this small area, more than 6,000 in the last week alone. Nearly a third are children under 5 years old. Afaf, 13, lost her mother and sister when an airstrike hit her front yard.
I was shocked. I just shouted and called for help. That's it.
But these families are not ordinary victims. Almost all are believed to be related to IS fighters. The women who arrived last night said that all of the men were taken for further screening. And unlike former battles, where most people denounced IS, some true believers from Baghouz are quick to deny their caliphate is falling.
All of the people inside Baghouz and those that are outside will find victory. May God grant them a victory.
Meanwhile, attacks continue almost every day. Observers, including aid workers, warn that without major changes, the defeat of IS here may just mark the end of this phase of the extremism that haunts the region.
There's a pattern of religious extremist movements, and this is only the latest. And so I think you have to counter it in two ways. One is you've got to immediately react to any violent action with force, because that's all they respect. But on the other hand, you have to look at some of the root causes, again, of injustice.
Syrian and international forces expect to declare the defeat of IS in the coming days, but it is still unclear if a victory will, in this case, also mean a win. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Deir ez-Zor, Syria.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways, including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOA's International Edition continues. It is a product that Americans use every single day and most likely don't realize that the toilet paper and tissues they use once, very briefly, and then throw away come from ancient forests. The Natural Resources Defense Council just released a groundbreaking new report, Issue with Tissue, that says ancient forests are being flushed down the toilet. The report exposes the practices of toilet paper and gives a sustainability scorecard ranking to the most popular brands. I talked about it with one of the report's authors, Shelley Vineyard. So even those of us who care deeply about protecting the environment have really not given much thought to where their paper, toilet paper, comes from.
It's quite alarming, and I think you're absolutely right. The average American probably doesn't think of their toilet paper choice as an environmental decision, but the truth is that clear-cutting forests for a throwaway product costs the planet a lot.
Can you give us specifics about what needs to be done to these forests in order to harvest the wood and make toilet paper?
Really, what we're asking is for the major toilet paper manufacturers like Procter & Gamble to make their toilet paper more sustainably by increasing the recycled content. The truth is that forests like the Canadian boreal, where a lot of tissue pulp comes from, are in grave danger and they're disappearing before our eyes. In fact, every minute, an area the size of 7 NHL hockey rinks is lost in the Canadian boreal.
I'm reading here that Americans use 3 rolls of toilet paper a week on average, and most of the major brands are using these trees that are clear cut from all of these old growth forests. Are there any brands that are doing it in a sustainable way?
Yeah, there are definitely sustainable alternatives available. In fact, in our report, we released a scorecard grading the major at-home brands and some of the more sustainable alternatives. So brands like 365's Everyday Value 100% Recycled Toilet Paper, Trader Joe's Bath Tissue, and Seventh Generation's Toilet Paper each earned an A in our scorecard. And that's largely because they have high amounts of recycled content in them.
You know, there are a lot of things that Americans do to try to cut corners when they purchase things. And I think a lot of the things that we see sometimes, like recycled products, like toilet paper, seem like they're more expensive and less, some Americans would say, appealing. They're always looking for the top name brands in toilet paper because they seem softer. Does that correlate in some way, the softness with the lack of recycling?
Major toilet paper manufacturers will say that consumers simply don't want toilet paper made with recycled content. But that ignores the fact that many consumers simply have no idea the environmental cost their toilet paper choices have. And something you use once and flush down the drain shouldn't be destroying the planet's remaining most important forest. I also think that question misses the bigger point, that we're at a point where the Canadian boreal forest is in peril, and the latest science says we need to do everything we can to address climate change, and that has to include companies like Procter & Gamble making its toilet paper with recycled content.
Have you all reached out to any of these companies to urge them to change their practices in order to be more environmentally conscious?
Yes, NRDC has asked Procter & Gamble and other major manufacturers to agree to change the way they make toilet paper so that their brands could be considered planet safe. They haven't for now, and we believe that consumers have a right to know how their tissue products are made. And by shining a light on this really critical environmental issue, we're giving them the power to shift market demand toward a sustainable future.
All right, that's Shelley Vineyard with the Natural Resources Defense Council. She is the co-author of the report, Issue with Tissue. R&B singer R. Kelly signed autographs and waved at fans when he stopped at McDonald's in downtown Chicago after being released from jail in his sexual abuse case. Kelly posted $100,000 bail late Monday after spending the weekend in Chicago's 7,000 inmate jail. He was arrested Friday on charges of sexually abusing four people dating back to 1998, including three underage girls. AP Entertainment editor Oscar Wells Gabriel reports.
When he was arrested Friday, a judge set R. Kelly's bond at $1 million, and that meant the singer had to put up 10% of that amount in order to go free pending trial. Court records showed that a 47-year-old woman from a Chicago suburb posted the $100,000 bail. The Chicago Tribune reports the woman identified herself on the bond slip as a friend of Kelly's.
That's AP Entertainment reporter Oscar Wells Gabriel. Finally, in music news today, on this day exactly 20 years ago, February 27th, 1999, when she was only 18 years old, Britney Spears' hit song Baby One More Time shot up to number one on the UK singles chart, and it stayed there at number one for 2 weeks. It also became the biggest selling single in the UK that year. The song was also number one for a time in the US. Her album with the same title, also a global success, made her the best-selling teenage artist of all time. And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.